loose on her skin. She walked the last weeks of high school wanting to eat every one of these delicious boys. If she had only been allowed, she would have swallowed them whole. She smiled at them hugely. They scurried away. She'd laughed, but felt it was a shame. None of this mattered. Since they were married, it had only ever been Lotto. She had been faithful. She was nearly certain he had been too. In her little house in the cherry orchard, the house of bleakest widowhood, Mathilde remembered and got up out of her dirty bed and showered. She dressed in the dark bathroom and crept past the room where Aunt Sally was whistle-snoring. Past the next room, door open, where her husband's sister Rachel looked at her passing from the pillow. In the dark, a face like a ferret's, triangular, alert, quivering. Mathilde got into the Mercedes. Her hair was in a wet bun, she was wearing no makeup, but it didn't matter. Three towns north there was a yuppie bar, and in the yuppie bar was a sad-faced man in a Red Sox cap, and a mile away in a little copse of trees where the road split, where they would have been pinned like moths on a board by headlights had any passed, she stood on her right leg, the left around the sad-faced Red Sox's jerky hips, and shouted, "Harder!" And the man's face, which had been first set in concentration, began taking on a look of alarm. And he kept on valiantly for some time while she shouted at him, "Harder! Faster, you fucker!" Until it was clear that he was spooked, and he faked an orgasm and pulled out and mumbled something about taking a whiz, and she heard his feet in the crunchy leaves as he hurried away. Rachel's face was still looking at Mathilde from the dark when she went back upstairs. The marital suite, the bed obscene in its empty enormity. In her absence, the sheets had been changed. When she climbed in again, they were cool and smelled like lavender and brushed her skin like accusations. There had been a time when she'd sat beside Lotto in the dark on the opening night of one of his wild earlier plays and was so overcome by what he'd done, the grandness of his vision being transmuted before her eyes, that she leaned across the space between them and licked his face from ear to lip. She couldn't help it. Just as, holding Rachel and Elizabeth's newborn daughter, she so longed to have the baby's innocence for herself that she put the tiny clenched fist in her mouth and held it there until the baby screamed. This widow's lust was the opposite of that. Widow. The word consumes itself, said Sylvia Plath, who consumed herself. 4. She had been overcome by fear over the apple crisp in the dining hall. She had fled to the bathroom and had been sitting, frozen, on the paper ring atop the toilet for a very long time. This was during the final days of college. For the previous month, she'd been frightened at the gulf the future opened before her. She, who had been in one cage or another since birth, was free to fly soon, but she was petrified at the thought of all that air. The door opened, and two girls came in, talking about how rich Lancelot Satterwhite was. "Bottled water princeling, you know," one said. "His mom's like a billionaire." "Lotto? Really?" said the other. "Shit, I hooked up with him freshman year. If only I'd known." The girls laughed, and then the first said, "Yeah, right. He's such a broho. I think I'm the only girl in the Hudson Valley who hasn't seen his junk. They say he never sleeps with a girl twice. Except Bridget. Which I don't get. She's so blah. I heard her saying they're dating, and I was like, really? I mean, she looks like a children's librarian. Like one who is caught in a perpetual rainstorm or something." "Yeah, well, Bridget is to dating Lotto the way a remora is to dating a shark." The girls laughed, left. Mathilde thought, huh. She flushed, came out, washed her hands. She looked at herself critically in the mirror. She smiled. "Hallelujah," she said aloud to the Mathilde in the mirror, and the Mathilde in the mirror said it back with her lovely lips, her pale and angular face. She claimed finals and eschewed the weekend trip to the city. She dressed carefully. She saw her quarry on stage that night and was impressed. He was very good, a manic Hamlet, puppyish in his energy, even if so very tall. From afar, the pits in his cheeks were not discernible, and he threw off a kind of golden light that cast even the audience in its glow. He made the shop-worn monologue sexy and showed it to them anew.
"'Tis a consummation, devoutly to be wished," he said, with a pirate smile,
and she imagined in seats all throughout the audience a tingly heat rising, promising. By the aisle lights, she read his full name in the program, Lancelot Lotto Satterwhite, and frowned. Lancelot. Well, she could make it work. The cast party was in a brutalist dorm where she'd never been. For 4 years, she had not allowed herself parties, friends. She couldn't risk them. She went early and stood out of the rain under a portico, smoking a cigarette. She was watching for Bridget. When the girl and her 3 dour friends came trotting up under umbrellas, Mathilde followed them inside. It was easy to separate Bridget from her friends. Mathilde only had to ask a question about serotonin reuptake inhibitors for their neurobiology class final in a few days, and the other girls faded away as Bridget earnestly explained. And then Mathilde refilled Bridget's cup with mostly vodka and a splash of Kool-Aid. Bridget was flattered to be talking to Mathilde.
"I mean, my God," she said, "you never, ever, ever go out. Everyone has heard about you, but nobody ever talks to you. You're like the white whale of Vassar."
Then she flushed and said,
"Like the skinniest, prettiest white whale ever."
And then said,
"Ah, you know what I mean."
She drank nervously. Mathilde refilled, and Bridget drank. Mathilde refilled, Bridget drank, and then Bridget was throwing up on the common stairway, and people who were trying to pass were saying, "Sick," and, "Oh my God, Bridget," and, "Nasty hoebag, take it outside." The friends had been summoned. Mathilde was watching through the banister from a higher landing when they took her home. Bridget went down the stairs, and Lotto passed her coming up. He said,
"Yikes,"
and patted her on the shoulder, and leapt the last few steps and went into the party. From her perch above, Mathilde had watched it all. The first problem dispatched. What ease. She stood outside in the chill rain, smoking 2 more cigarettes, listening to the party. She gave it 10 songs. When Salt and Pepper was playing, she went back inside, up the stairs. She looked across the room. There he was on the windowsill, drunk, bellowing, and it took her by surprise how very muscular that body of his was. He was wearing some girl's gel eye mask as a loincloth. He had an empty water jug ace bandage to his head. No dignity, but Christ, there was beauty. His face was strange, as if it had once been handsome, and still was from afar. But she had seen him only clothed before now, and would not have guessed at how perfect his body was. She had made so many calculations, but none involved her legs melting from under her with the instant desire to screw. She willed him to look up, to see her. He looked up. He saw her. His face went still. He stopped dancing. She felt the hair of her neck stand. He leapt into the crowd and crushed some poor tiny girl in falling and swam his way out and over to Mathilde. He was taller than she was. She measured 6 feet, 6'3" in these heels. Men taller than she was were rare. She liked the unexpected feeling of being smaller, more delicate. He touched her hand. He went down on one knee and shouted up,
"Marry me!"
And she didn't know what to do. She laughed and looked down at him and said,
"No!"
In the story he told of this, spun at so many parties, so many dinners, she listening with her smile, her head cocked, laughing slightly. She said, sure. She never corrected him, not once. Why not let him live with his illusion? It made him happy. She loved making him happy. Sure. It wasn't true, not for another 2 weeks when she would marry him, but it did no harm. Lotto had made the story of their meeting a coup de foudre, but he was a born storyteller. He recast reality into a different kind of truth. It was, as she knew, actually a coup de foudre. Their marriage had always been about the sex. It had been about other things at first, and would be about other things later, of course, but within days, it was about the sex. She'd held out until she'd settled her previous commitments, and the wait had inflamed both. For a long time after, the genital had taken primacy over other concerns. Even then, she knew that there is no such thing as sure. There is no absolute anything. The gods love to fuck with us. Yet it's true there was, for a brief spell, a happiness that was absolute. It was sure. It swallowed her whole. Dim day, rocky beach. She felt the joy even through the tiny irritations, the sandflies that bit and the cold that soaked to her bones and the sharp stones on the main beach that split her hallux open like a sliced grape and made her limp back to the house they'd borrowed for their wedding day. They were 22, the world drenched with potential, as fine as they'd ever be. She kept her hands warm on her new husband's back and felt the muscles moving under his skin. A shell dug into her spine. She felt herself engulf him. First consummation as husband and wife. She thought of a boa swallowing a fawn. If he'd had flaws then, she couldn't see them. And perhaps it was true. Perhaps she had found the only faultless person in the world. Even if she had dreamt of him, she couldn't have come up with him. Innocent, charming, funny, loyal. Rich. Lancelot Satterwhite. Lotto. They had been married that morning. She was grateful to the sand that eked its way into the knotty bits and stung. She couldn't trust pleasure in its pure form. But their first married consummation was over so fast. He laughed into her ear, she into his throat. It didn't matter. Their separate selves had elided. She was no longer alone. She was crushed with gratitude. He helped her up, and they bowed to gather their clothing, and the ocean over the dune applauded. All weekend she rang with joy. One weekend should have been enough. She was given so much more than she deserved. But she was greedy. Brilliant May sun on the drive back from their stolen honeymoon. Lotto, who would always be labile as a preteen, drove, and, hearing a sweet song, burst into tears. She did the only thing she could think of, and put her head in his lap, and disinterred little Lotto to make big Lotto stop. A semi, in passing, honked its approval. Back in Poughkeepsie, in front of her apartment, she said, "I want to know everything about you. I want to meet your mother and aunt and sister immediately. Let's fly to Florida after graduation. I want to eat your life." She laughed a little at her own earnestness. Oh, to have a mother, a family. She'd been alone for so long. She'd let herself daydream of a kind mother-in-law who took her away for spa days, who had in-jokes, who sent small presents with notes saying, "Saw this, thought of you." But there was something wrong. After a moment, Lotto put her knuckles to his mouth and said, "Em, my love, we'll have the rest of our lives for that." A vein of cold shot through her. What was this? Hesitation? Perhaps he was already ashamed of her. Before her rose the Cranach diptych. Adam and Eve with the long thighs, tiny heads, huge feet cold at the knuckles. It's true that even in Eden there were snakes.
I have to write my sociology final,
he said apologetically.
I have 6 hours till it's due, but I'll bring us dinner tonight after I hand it in. I love you beyond love.
Me too, she said, closing the car door and trying to stifle the panic. She came into her apartment, which had contracted, filled as it was with her small and gray previous life. She took a hot bath and climbed under her down comforter for a nap. She was deep in a dream when her phone rang. It had to be bad. Nothing but badness would be calling so insistently. She braced herself.
Yes, she said.
Well, hello, said a soft, sweet voice. Come to find out you're my daughter, and I don't even know you from Cain. It took Matilda a moment, and then she said,
Mrs. Satterwhite, it's so lovely to finally speak with you.
But the voice didn't stop.
I must confess that I did what any doting mother would do, and I made inquiries as to who you are and where you're from. My inquiries ended up in some strange places. You are lovely, just as I was told. I've seen your photographs, those bra catalog ones particularly, even though your bosoms seem rather smallish, and I wonder at the person who hired you to show them off. To speak honestly, if I may, I didn't love the spread in the Teeny Boppers magazine, where you looked like a half-drowned rat terrier, bless your heart. Funny that people would pay you to look like that in public. But some of your photos are very fine. You're a pretty girl. Good match for my Lancelot, at least in looks.
Thank you, Matilde said, wary.
But you're not a church-going girl, and frankly, that gives me pause. A heathen in the family, she said. Not sure I like it. Much worse is what I come to find out about your uncle, the people he's mixed up with. Shady beyond all measure. You only really know about a person when you know about their kin. I must say, I do not like what I have come to find out. Add this to my fear of the kind of person who seduces such a kind-hearted boy as mine and marries him in such a short courtship. Only a very dangerous or a very calculating person could do such a thing. All these things put together make me believe that you and I would have a hard time seeing eye to eye. Not in this lifetime, at least.
Well, Matilde said, seems that ours will be your standard mother-in-law-daughter-in-law relationship, Antoinette.
They both laughed.
You may call me Mrs. Satterwhite, Lotto's mother said.
I may. Probably won't, Matilde said. How's mother sound to you?
You're a tough little cookie, aren't you? Said Antoinette. Well, my Lancelot is so tender-hearted that the woman he marries has got to be a little hard. I am, however, afraid that someone won't be you.
Already is, Matilde said. How can I help you? What do you want?
The question, my girl, is what you want. I assume you know that Lancelot comes from money.
Oh, of course you know. That's why you married him. Going together for 2 weeks, no way you actually love the dear boy, lovable as he may be. Knowing my son as I do, he hasn't told you yet how you aren't going to see a penny of my money while I've got breath to breathe and he's married to you. We discussed it all yesterday morning after you did the deed, and he called me up to gloat. Impetuous, both of you, acting like the children you still are. And now you're penniless. I do wonder how you feel at this moment. I'm so sorry that all your plans are coming to naught.
Despite herself, Matilde caught her breath. Antoinette continued,
Of course, that means you'd do far better for yourself to get it all annulled. Take $100,000 and call it a day.
Ha! Matilde said. Darling, you name your price, I don't mind. Not the time to be cheap, I suppose. Say the word, and it'll be done. Just ask what you require to start up your life after graduation, and you'll have it all wired this afternoon, and you can sign some papers and just walk away. Leave my poor child in peace. Let him sow his wild oats, eventually find himself some good, sweet girl, and come home to Florida to me.
Interesting, Mathilde said. You're possessive for a woman who couldn't bother to visit her son for a whole year.
Well, darling, you grow a baby in your belly for near on a year. You see your husband and yourself in his face. Of course you'll be possessive. He's my blood. I made him. You'll see someday.
I won't, Mathilde said.
500? No? Would 1,000,000 do? Said Antoinette. All you have to do is abandon ship. Take your money and run. You could do what you like with $1,000,000. Travel, see foreign cultures, open up your own business, run your hustle on richer men. The world is your oyster, Mathilde Yoder. Consider this that first grain of sand to make your pearl.
You sure have the gift of the mixed metaphor, Mathilde said. I admire it, in a way.
I take it from your comment that we have come to an accord. Excellent choice. You're not stupid. I shall call my attorney, and some boy will bring the papers by in a few hours.
Oh, wow, Mathilde said softly. It is going to be so, so wonderful.
Yes, darling. Sensible of you to take the deal. Good chunk of change it is.
No, Mathilde said. I meant that it will be so wonderful to think up all the ways to keep your son far away from you. It'll be our little game. You'll see. All the holidays, all the birthdays, all the times when you're sick. Something urgent will come up, and your son will have to stay with me. He'll be with me, not you. He will choose me, not you.
Mother, Lotto calls you Mother, so I will too. Until you apologize, until you force yourself to be nice, you won't lay your eyes on him again.
She put the phone gently on the hook and unplugged it and went to take a second bath, her t-shirt having gone transparent with sweat. In a few days, she'd get the first of many notes that Antoinette would send her through the years, spiky with exclamation points. In return, Mathilde would send back photos of Lotto and Mathilde, smiling together. Lotto and Mathilde by the pool. Lotto and Mathilde in San Francisco. Mathilde in Lotto's arms, stepping over every threshold of every new place they'd have. That evening, when Lotto came back, she said nothing. They watched a sitcom. They took a shower together. Later, naked, they ate calzones.
5.
Time, after Lotto died, swallowed itself. Sally saw it was useless to try to get through. Mathilde was numb still. A force field of fury so thick nobody was going to get in. Sally went back to Asia, to Japan this time. She'd return in a year, when Mathilde wasn't so angry, she said.
I'll always be angry, Mathilde said.
Sally put her dry brown hand on Mathilde's face and barely smiled. Only Lotto's sister returned again and again. Dear, sweet Rachel, pure of heart.
Here's an apple pie, she'd say. Here's a loaf of bread. Here's a handful of chrysanthemums. Here's my daughter. Hold her. Salve your sorrow.
Everyone else gave her space, gave her time.
Christ, did you have any idea Mathilde could be such a bitch? Friends said, wounded, returning home.
Would you have guessed it when Lotto was alive? Can you believe what she said to us?
She's possessed by some demon, they said.
Grief, they all said knowingly, feeling profound. Tacitly agreed, They would return when she was her seemly, elegant, smiling self again. In their own place, they sent gifts. Samuel sent potted bromeliads. Charlie sent towers of Belgian chocolates. Danica sent her personal masseuse, whom Mathilde sent away by ignoring him. Arnie sent a case of wine. Ariel sent a long black dress in cashmere, which Mathilde curled for days within. Strange that this soft gift from an old boss would be the only perfect thing. Late one night, Mathilde found herself on a long, straight strip of road. The car a top-of-the-line Mercedes that Lotto had bought just before croaking. His mother had died half a year before her son, and they'd come into an inheritance so vast it was foolish they were driving their 15-year-old Honda Civic with the iffy airbags. He'd only ever cared about money when it came to his own comfort. Otherwise, he left it for others to worry about. She put the pedal to the floor. Responsive as fuck. The car shot to 80, to 95, to 110. She flipped off the lights, and the darkness rose to her like a daydream. Moonless night, the car slack like a fish brushing along the walls of a cave. After one lifetime, she went stationary, suspended in darkness. Calm. Her car hit the culvert, brushed up the embankment, vaulted a barbed wire fence, somersaulted. It landed in a herd of sleeping Jerseys. Mathilde's mouth was bleeding. She'd bitten nearly through her tongue. No matter. She spoke to nobody these days. Otherwise, she was unhurt. She climbed out of the car, swallowing the gushes of coppery heat. The heifers had moved off, were watching from the shelter of windblock lindens. But one was still kneeling beside the car. When Mathilde walked around to it, there was a wall of blood where its neck had been. She watched for a long time as it bled into the grass. There was nothing to be done. There was nothing to be done, and now what? Mathilde was 46. She was too young to be finished forever with love. Still in her prime, fine-looking, desirable, and uncoupled now for good. The story we are told of women is not this one. The story of women is the story of love, of foundering into another. A slight deviation, longing to founder and being unable to. Being left alone in the foundering and taking things into one's own hands. Rat poison, the wheels of a Russian train. Even the smoother and gentler story is still just a modified version of the above. In the demotic, in the key of bougie, it's the promise of love in old age for all the good girls of the world. Hilarious ancient bodies at bath time, husbands' palsied hands soaping wife's withered dugs, erection popping out of the bubbles like a pink periscope. I see you. There would be long, hobbledy walks under the plane trees, stories told by a single sideways glance. One word sufficing. Anthill, he'd say. Martini, she'd say. And the thick swim of the old joke would return to them. The laughter, the beautiful reverberations. Then the bleary toddling on to an early bird dinner, snoozing through a movie hand in hand. Their bodies like knobby sticks wrapped in vellum. One laying the other on the deathbed, feeding the overdose. Dying the day after, all heart gone out of the world with the beloved breath. Oh, companionship! Oh, romance! Oh, completion! Forgive her if she believed this would be the way it would go. She had been led to this conclusion by forces greater than she. Conquers all! All you need is a many-splendored thing. Surrender to... Like corn rammed down goosenecks, this shit they'd swallowed since they were barely old enough to dress themselves in tulle. The way the old story goes, woman needs an other to complete her circuits, to flick her to fullest blazing. The refutation would come. During those dusky years of her 80s, in the far-off beyond the horizon, she would sit solitary over tea in her London breakfast room and look up to see her own hand like an ancient map, and then out the window where a blue budgerigar peered in, naturalized citizen of this unnatural subtropical world. Suddenly clear in the small blue shape, she would see her life had not been, at its core, about love. There had been terrific love in it, heat and magic, Lotto, her husband. Christ, there had been him. Yet, yes, the sum of her life, she saw, was far greater than its sum of love. In the immediacy, though, in stingy moonlight over bruised metal, cow flesh, glass, there was only her bitten tongue and all that blood. The hot, rust-tasting flood of it, and the great now-what stretching without end. 6. One day, the little girl she once was, small Aurélie, found herself with a blue suitcase in her hand and her hair scraped back from her face. She must have been 5 or 6.
"You're off to your Paris grandmother's," her tall Breton grandmother said.
There had always been something off about the Paris grandmother, something embarrassing. Her own mother had never spoken of her. They had rarely talked on the phone. Aurélie had never met her. There were never pretty parcels from that grandmother on her saint's day. They were standing in the aisle of a train, the grandmother's frown stretched to her second chin.
"Your mother's mother was the only relative who would take you," she said.
"I don't care," Aurélie said.
"Of course you don't,"
the grandmother said. She gave her a packet of sandwiches and hard-boiled eggs, a jar of warm milk, 2 chaussons aux pommes, and pinned a note to her coat.
"Don't you dare move from your seat," she said,
and gave the girl a bristly kiss on the cheek and wiped the red rims of her eyes with a starched handkerchief and left. The train hooted. All Aurélie knew of the world slid out from under her feet. The village, black and white cows, chickens, huge Gothic church, bakery. She saw what she was searching for when the train picked up speed. There, a flash. White hatchback parked under a yew. Oh, her mother, standing cross-armed, pale, in a navy dress, her hair, yes, white blonde, under a scarf, watching the train go. Her mouth a red slash in the pale. Dress, hair beginning to froth in the train's wind. It was hard to tell what was happening on her face. Then her mother was gone. Across from Aurélie was a man who stared at her. He had pale, shining skin and puffy folds under his eyes. She squeezed hers shut to avoid him, but every time she looked, he was staring. A terrible certainty stole over her. She tried to block it, to squeeze her legs, but it was no use. She pressed both her hands against herself to hold the urine in. The man leaned forward.
"Little girl," he said, "I will escort you to the lavatory."
"No,"
she said. He reached forward to touch her, and she gave a scream, and the fat woman with the dog on her lap in the other corner opened her eyes and glared.
"Silence,"
she snarled.
"Come to the lavatory,"
the man said. His teeth were many and tiny.
"No,"
Aurélie said, and let go. The urine was deliciously hot on her thighs. The man said, "Ugh," and left the carriage, and the pee gradually turned cold. For hours, as the train rocked eastward, the fat woman in the corner gelatined in her sleep, and her lapdog sniffed the air voluptuously, as if tasting it. All at once, they were at the station. The grandmother stood before her. She was a woman as pretty as Aurélie's mother, apple cheeks and thick eyebrows, even if this version was wrinkled around the eyes. She was astonishing. Her clothes were both grand and tattered at the same time. The perfume she wore, her elegant hands like pencils in a soft suede case. The grandmother leaned over, took the packet, and looked in.
Ah, good peasant food, she said.
She was missing a lower incisor, which gave her smile some dash.
We shall sup well tonight, she said.
When Aurélie stood, she revealed the wetness of her lap. Over the grandmother's face, like a roller blind flipping upward, the refusal to see.
Come along,
she said airily, and Aurélie took her suitcase and came along. The pee dried as she walked and chafed her thighs. On the way home, they bought a single sausage from a butcher who appeared to be seething silently. The grandmother took the suitcase and made the girl hold the white paper package. By the time they reached the heavy blue door of the building, her hands were stained with clammy red grease. Her grandmother's flat was sparse, if neat. The floors were bare wood, scrubbed skin-like. There had once been pictures on the walls, and they'd left dark shadows on the otherwise pale, passion-flowered wallpaper. It was no warmer inside, simply less windy. The grandmother saw the girl shivering and said,
"Heat costs money."
She made her jump 50 times to warm herself.
"Jumping's free," she said.
A broom handle from below made a rat-a-tat-tat on the floor. They ate. Aurélie was shown to her room, a closet with a quilt doubled for a bed on the ground, low-hanging canopy of the grandmother's clothing, smelling powerfully of her skin.
"Until I move you to the closet for the night, you will sleep in my bed," the grandmother said.
Aurélie said her prayers while the grandmother watched. Aurélie pretended to sleep as the grandmother washed herself carefully, brushed her teeth with baking soda, put on more makeup and perfume. She left. Aurélie watched the light bulb's curves on the ceiling. When she woke, she was being carried to her closet. The door was closed. In the bedroom, a man's voice, her grandmother's, the bed squeaking. The next day, it was decided that she should just stay in the closet the whole time and was given her mother's old Tintin books and a flashlight. Over time, she would recognize three men's voices, one rich, as if encased in fat like a pâté, one helium giggling, one with rocks in it. The grandmother kept perishables on the windowsill, where the pigeons and rats sometimes got them. The men came and left. Aurélie dreamt of adventures in strange, cartoonish lands, ignored the noises, eventually slept through them. She went off to school and delighted in neatness, the pens with their cartouches, graph paper, the cleanness of orthography. She loved the goûter that the school gave out, madeleines filled with chocolate and milk in pouches. She loved the loudness of the other children, watched them with delight. And so it went for 6 years or so. In the spring after her 11th birthday, Aurélie came home and found her grandmother in déshabille on the bed. She was stiff, skin icy, tongue protruding. There may have been marks on her neck, or maybe they were kisses. No. Two of her nails had been ripped off, and the fingers ended in blood. Aurélie went slowly downstairs. The concierge was not in her apartment. Aurélie went down the street and shuddered in the green grocer's shop at the corner until he finished weighing asparagus for a lady in a fur hat. He was kind to Aurélie, gave her oranges in the winter. When they were alone, he leaned forward, smiling, and she whispered what she'd seen, and his face went stark. He took off running. Later, she found herself on a plane over the Atlantic. Below, clouds feathered. Water pleated and smoothed itself. The stranger in the seat beside her had a pillowy biceps and a gentle hand, which passed over and over Aurélie's hair until at last the girl slept. When she woke, she was in her new country. Her French professors at Vassar had marveled. "You have no accent at all," they said.
"Oh, well," she said lightly, "maybe I was a little French girl in a previous life."
In this one, she was American, sounded American. Her mother tongue stayed under the surface. But the way roots push up paving stones from beneath, her French rippled her English. The way she said, fort, as in, making your life run on rails, Lotto, that's my fort. And in her mouth it was strength, feminine. Lotto looked at her curiously, said,
forte, you mean?
In the American way. Forte, a nonsense word. Of course, she said. Or the faux ami. Actually, for currently. Abuse, for mislead. I cannot breathe, she said, in the lobby on opening night, the crowd rushing Lotto. In this affluence. She'd meant crowd, but, well, on second thought, the other worked just as well. Despite her fluency, she would mishear, misinterpret. Her whole adult life she would believe one kept all one's important things, wills, birth certificates, passports, a single photo of a little girl, in a place in the bank called the safety deposit box. Security, a hypothetical, remaining to be proved. 7. Her tongue was still healing from when she flipped the car. Mathilde said very little. The tongue hurt, true, but silence became her. When she spoke, she showed her contempt. She went out at night and picked men up. The doctor still in his scrubs, smelling of iodine and clove cigarettes. The boy who sold gas at Stewart's, with his downy mustache and ability to pump for hours like a lonely derrick on the dry Texas plains. The mayor of the little village where Mathilde and Lotto had lived so happily. The owner of the bowling alley. A shy divorcee with shockingly floral taste in bed linens. A cowboy with $400 boots, he'd informed her with pride. A black jazz saxophonist in town for a wedding. By then she'd made a name for herself without saying anything at all. School superintendent, owner of a hunting camp, CrossFit trainer with deltoids like hand grenades, a semi-famous poet she and her husband had known from the city who'd come up to visit her on an impulsive hajj of Lotto grief. He'd put three fingers up her, and she felt the cold of his wedding band. She picked up a fat, balding man who drove school buses. He only wanted to hold her and weep. Disgusting, she said. She was in the middle of the motel room, still in her bra. She'd shorn her hair to velveteen that day in the pool. The locks had drifted atop the surface like drowned snakes. Stop crying, she said.
I can't, he said. I'm sorry.
You are sorry, she said.
You're just so pretty,
he said.
And I'm so lonely.
She sat down heavily on the edge of the bed. There was a jungle scene on the comforter.
Can I put my head in your lap?
He said. If you have to, she said. He lowered his cheek to her thighs. She braced herself against the weight of his head. His hair was soft and smelled of unscented soap, and from this vantage his skin was very sweet, pink and smooth like a piglet's.
My wife passed away,
he said, his mouth tickling her leg.
6 months ago. Breast cancer.
My husband died 4 months ago, she said. Aneurysm. Pause. I win, she said. His eyelashes brushed her skin while he thought about this.
So you know,
he said. I do, she said. The flick of the traffic light across the street from the motel filled the room with red and dark and red and dark. How do you live? She said.
Ladies with casseroles. My kids call me every day. I've taken up kite building. It's all so stupid,
he said. I don't have kids, she said.
I'm sorry,
he said. Not me. Best decision I ever made, she said.
How do you live?
He said. By fucking the brains out of disgusting men.
Hey,
he said, then laughed.
How's that working out for you?
Awful.
Then why do you do it?
Slowly, she said,
my husband was the second man I'd had sex with. I was faithful for 24 years. I want to know what I was missing. What were you missing? He said.
Nothing. Men are all absolutely terrible at sex. Except for my husband. She thought, well, there had been one or two surprises, but mostly that was true. He picked his moon face up off her lap, pink dent on her thigh, moisture. He looked at her hopefully.
I've been told I'm an excellent lover, he said.
She pulled her dress on over her head and zipped her boots to her knees.
Missed your window there, buddy, she said. Oh, come on, he said. I'll be quick.
Christ almighty, she said, and put her hand on the doorknob. His voice went bitter when he said,
have a good time being a whore.
You poor, sad little man, she said, and went out without turning around. There was nothing Mathilde could do. Flickering images hurt her head, books left her hollow. She was so tired of the old way of telling stories, all those two-worn narrative paths, the familiar plot thickets, the fat social novels. She needed something messier, something sharper, something like a bomb going off. She drank a great deal of wine and fell asleep, and when she woke, it was in the middle of the night to a cold bed empty of her husband. That was when she knew, with existential bitterness, that her husband had understood nothing of her. Somehow, despite her politics and smarts, she had become a wife, and wives, as we all know, are invisible. The midnight elves of marriage, the house in the country, the apartment in the city, the taxes, the dog, all were her concern. He had no idea what she did with her time. It would have been compounded with children. Thank goodness for childlessness, then. There was also this. For a number of his plays, at least half, she would silently steal in at night and refine what he had written. Not rewrite, edit, burnish, make glow. And she ran the business side of his work. She had horrified visions of all the money he would have let evaporate in his goodwill and indolence. Once, during the previews of The House in the Grove, when, it felt, they were on the brink of a flop, she had been in the office of the theater. Deep afternoon, rain and coffee. She had been reaming out a script supervisor with such softly vicious skill that the poor boy's knees went out from under him and he had to sit on a crimson ottoman to gather himself. When she finished, she said, "You are dismissed." The boy stood and fled. She hadn't seen Lotto in the shadows of the hallway, glooming there.
"So," he said, "when directors ask members of the cast to come see you, I gather it's not for a pep talk. I had always thought it was for a pep talk. Magic cookie bars and café au lait, a nice little cry on your bosom."
"Some people just need a different kind of motivation," she said. She stood and stretched her neck, one side, the other.
"If I hadn't seen it," he said, "I wouldn't have believed it."
"Would you like me to stop?" she said. She wouldn't. They'd be in the poorhouse. But she could keep it quieter, make sure he wouldn't know. He stepped in and locked the door behind him.
"In truth, it turned me on," he said.
He came close and said,
"I see her indeed in the image of a Valkyrie maiden, riding her steed into the circle, amid thunder and lightning and out again, bearing the body of some dead hero across her saddle."
He picked her up and wrapped her legs around his hips and turned and pressed her back against the door. Was he quoting? She didn't care. His voice was full of admiration. She closed her eyes. "Giddy up, steed," she said. he nickered in her ear. She had a self she didn't devote to him. For one thing, she wrote, and not just invisibly in his manuscripts, which he must have thought magically tidied themselves up in the night. She wrote her own things that she kept to herself, surreptitious, sharp objects, part story, part poetry, published under a pseudonym. She'd begun in despair when she was almost 40, and he'd fallen and broken himself, and in the break, she felt him moving away from her. There was the other thing, the far worse thing. During the same time she began to write, she left him. He was wrapped up in his work. She came back, and he never knew she was gone. She'd seen the artist's colony when she dropped Lotto off. They brought you lunch in wicker baskets and gave you your own stone cottage, with these long, laughing conversations at night over candlelight. It had seemed a version of heaven. She'd held his face as she moved over him on the small and squeaky bed, but he'd turned her over, and when he shivered and gasped and put his head on her back to catch his breath, she felt a chill. She laughed off the premonition and drove away. For a few weeks she'd be left alone in the tiny country house with God. At first, she was sanguine. Her poor husband had had such a bad summer. There had been that spill down the airplane stairs, half of his body broken. He'd drunk too much, worked too little on his new play, been so very sad not to be at his high pitch of activity for so many months with all of the workshops and productions and business. And though she had been happy to have him to attend to in the house with her, to love him with her cupcakes and iced tea and bathing and many tiny kindnesses, she was glad when she took him for his birthday to the podunk little opera house among the cow fields and watched his face as he sat forward, as he drank it all up, the tears shimmering in his eyes. She watched the contrails at intermission as a woman slunk up to greet him, blushing under the heat of his celebrity. Lotto, body broken, his expression so light, so ecstatic. It had been so long since all his faculties had been engaged. So she had been fine to drop him off that gray November, to take a few weeks off from the constant care of him. He would be working with a young composer on an opera, Leo Sen. But even the first week without Lotto, her life, her house, had been so empty. She forgot meals, ate dinners of tuna still in the can, spent too much time streaming films in bed. Time clicked by. The days grew colder, darker. Some days she never turned on the light, waking at 8 when the sun rose weakly, sleeping at 4:30 when it bled itself out. She felt ursine, Norwegian. Her husband's calls trickled down from once a day to every few days. In her half-sleep, she had fiery nightmares of Lotto telling her he no longer needed her. He was leaving. He loved another woman. In her fever, she imagined some poetess, frail and young, with heifer hips molded for birthing, a girl who was respected in her own rights as an artist, which Mathilde would never be. He would divorce Mathilde, and he and his new, whispery paramour would live in the apartment in the city in a glut of sex and parties and babies, endless babies, all with his face in miniature. She imagined the poetess almost into existence. She was so lonely, she could choke on it. She called and called, and he never answered the telephone. His calls decreased even more. He called once the last week. He didn't try to get kinky with her, which was so strange for Lotto that he could have been neutered. He skipped Thanksgiving, though they'd had plans with friends and family in the house in the country. She'd had to cancel, ate the custard out of the pumpkin pie she'd made the day before, and tossed the crust out the window for the raccoons. On the phone, Mathilde's voice had wobbled. Lotto's voice went distant. He said he was extending the stay into mid-December. She said something cutting and hung up. He called 3 times, and she didn't pick up. The 4th time, she would, she decided. But though she waited by the phone, he didn't call back. When he'd talked of Leo, there was a pulse under his words, a thrill. And suddenly, she could taste his infatuation. It left a bitterness on the back of her tongue. Mathilde dreamt of Leo Sen. She knew he was a young man, from the few bios that existed online, and though Lotto was thoroughly straight, the daily greedy need of his hands told her this. Her husband's desire had always been more to chase and capture the gleam of the person inside the body than the body itself. And there was a part of her husband that had always been so hungry for beauty. It was out of the question that Leo Sen's body could steal her husband. It was not out of the question that with his genius, Leo could take her place in Lotto's affections. This was worse. In the dream, they were sitting at a table, Mathilde and Leo, and there was a giant pink cake, and though Mathilde was hungry, Leo was eating the cake, delicate bite by delicate bite, and she had to watch him eat it, smiling shyly until it was gone. She sat for a long, long time at the kitchen table, and every moment she sat, the anger took on mass, then darkness, then scales. "I'll show him," she said aloud to God. God wagged her tail sadly. The dog missed Lotto, too. It took 10 minutes to make the arrangements, another 20 to pack herself and the dog. She drove off through the cherry trees, resolutely not looking at the little white house in the rearview mirror. God had shivered when she handed her over at the kennel. Mathilde had shivered all the way to the airport, on the plane, had taken 2 Ambien, and stopped shivering to sleep all the way to Thailand, waking with a bleary head and a blossoming urinary tract infection from holding her bladder while she slept. When she walked out of the airport into the humidity, the human roil, the tropical stink and wind, her legs went weak. Bangkok flashed by, pink and gold, swarms of bodies beneath the streetlights. Strands of holiday light snaked up the trees, a kindness to the tourists. Mathilde's skin was thirsty for the moist wind, now blowing rotten with marsh reeds and mud, now blowing eucalyptus. She was too agitated for sleep, the hotel too hygienic, so she wandered back out into the dark. A bent woman swept a sidewalk with a bundle of sticks, a rat perched atop a wall. Mathilde wanted the bitterness of a gin and tonic on her tongue and followed music blindly under a portico into a nightclub, empty so early in the night. Inside was tiered, balconied, the stage being set up for a band. The bartender patted Mathilde's hand when she delivered the drink, flash of warmth on the skin, then the cold of the glass, and Mathilde wanted to touch the lushness of the woman's black eyelashes. Someone sat beside her, an American man, bursting out of his t-shirt, his head fuzzy like a ripe peach. Beside him, a plump and laughing Thai woman. His voice oozed with intimacy. He'd already taken possession. Mathilde wanted to seize his words, roll them up in her fist, shove them down his throat. Instead, she left, found the hotel, lay sleepless in bed until dawn. In the morning, she found herself on a boat to the PP Islands, salt on her lips from the wind. She had her own bungalow. She'd paid for a month, imagining Lotto coming home to an empty house, no dog, searching all the rooms for her, finding nothing, the terror hatching in his heart. Had someone kidnapped her? Had she run away with the circus? She was so agreeably flexible when it came to Lotto that she could have been a contortionist. Her hotel room was white and full of carved wood. They'd put polished, strange fruits in a red bowl on the table and a towel folded in the shape of an elephant on the bed. She opened the French door to the shushing sea, the call of children down the beach, and stripped the bed of its comforter because she wanted other people's germs nowhere near her skin, and lay back and closed her eyes and felt the old devastation rasp itself away. When she woke, it was dinner time, and the devastation was back, sharp-toothed, and it had gnawed a hole inside her. She cried in the mirror, putting on her dress, her lipstick, cried too much for eye makeup. She sat at her own table alone, among the flowers and shining cutlery, and kind people served her kindly and positioned her facing the sea so she could cry in peace. She ate